Hey, Swisspreneur listeners. Every year, Swisspreneur hosts three scale-up events for its community of founders and investors. In 2024, our first get-together will be the Scale-Up Slopes in the beautiful Locks on March 1st. Join us for a day of skiing or co-working among fellow entrepreneurs and VCs, followed by a flying dinner with a mountain view and a keynote speaker from a well-known Swiss scale-up. The event is open to all entrepreneurs interested in learning about the scale-up journey. Click the link in the show notes and apply to join before January 30th to get an early bird discount. We hope to see you there.
Imposter syndrome is part of most of our lives. I mean, those of us who came from another world that is much smaller, most of us, many women have it. I certainly have it. I talked about it. But I never let it make me decide whether or not I'd take a chance. I mean, I just, like, usually I struggled with it, then I did it anyway.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Thomas, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure and a huge honor to have you here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
You are a professor at ETH for space, and you are the former head of science at NASA. Before we talk about your impressive career, I actually want to start with your personal background. You were born in the canton of Bern back in the late 60s, and your dad was a free church preacher who didn't want you to go to university. So I wonder, why not, and what sort of career plan did he have envisioned for you?
I think what's important to recognize, right, is a perfectly good man and very innovative in his own way. He started that church, you know, and kind of, I mean, many people, you know, that start movements, you know, don't get to a place where hundreds of people basically think that what they're doing is one of the most important things on earth for them. But he lived in a world that's defined by that, right? And kind of all the options were really in that world. So those are the people who are there, kind of our farming communities and kind of more labor-related things. Yes, there were the occasional technical person, but very few, none of them that I was close of, except my cousin who was much older. None of them ever went to university. And none of them really looked at certainly science careers. Frankly, the only way science was used is often as a proof of how we should believe in the Lord's word in the Bible because the scientists are always wrong, which of course they are. That's what science is about, is to prove things wrong and right, by the way. But to prove things wrong is a really important part.
Mm-hmm. And yet you decided to go to university, to the University of Bern. You studied astrophysics. What made you want to swim against the tide and against the suggestions of your dad?
I think it really is the power of public education. I mean, that being a physicist has nothing to do initially with opening that world up. That's gymnasium and everything that goes with it, like learning languages, learning history, learning about arts, learning about science. And of course, for me, science and math was easier than for other people. It was easier for me to understand, but I like the others too. I read a lot of books about explorers, you know, anywhere from Magellan to Columbus to, you know, like whatever they're all called. And so for me, kind of really education opened up the door. It was one class in gymnasium that made me want to be a physicist. And frankly, it was not a class about science. It was a class about Copernicus and his insights into science, how that insight really changed not only what we know, but how we think as humans.
Wow. And how was that, the conversation at home? Was that a difficult one when you decided to actually go to university?
Initially, the university decision to go to university, in many ways, there was also some pride, right? Kind of hidden pride. We would have never talked about it that way. But you know, it's kind of from a small farm village, you know, like very often, you know, and let's talk about it, right? In Switzerland, kind of the farm villages are kind of looked down upon by many people. Mm-hmm. They look simple. They're like, you know, the political opinions they have, many people disrespect. And so kind of when somebody comes up from a place like this, you know, they're they're going into the other world, which is more a city world, right? Kind of, there's a sense of pride, but kind of over time, you know, we realized we were on diverging paths, you know, kind of roads that initially look parallel, but then kind of more and more went apart. And if you, it's like you can't stand on two boats at the same, with one leg each, right? If they fall, go away from each other. And, you know, like initially it fell apart.
You had to make a decision then which boat you wanted to stand on.
Yeah, I mean, kind of initially I jumped onto the place where I thought kind of my future was. It's just a future of far less certainty, by the way. Yeah. Far less certainty. It was a future of exploration, a future of also love, a future of disappointment, but a future of what I felt was a lot more aligned with what my desires were than a future of predetermined truths that were already clear and nothing really remained to be discovered related to that.
Right. And you continued that path of jumping into the uncertain waters. After your PhD, you then moved to the United States. That was in 1996. What sort of culture shock have you experienced by moving to the US back then?
So, you know, what's really interesting, you know, many entrepreneurs listen to your show here. And one of the things that I just want to quickly talk about is that we admire a lot of people who do amazing things. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, like whoever they're called. And many of them have really dark sides to their story. And when people want to aspire to be them, they often don't realize the dark sides. So for me, I just want to tell you, going to the US was simple. Why? Because I was kicked out of my house, right? So for me, kind of the transition to gymnasium, then from gymnasium to Bern, was much bigger because I lost my family and my friends all at once, right? So I had no relation point to anywhere. When I went to the US, of course, there's a culture shock, right? So you drive more and fewer trams and trains, and, you know, like the speed is higher, but it was a lot simpler because ultimately I talked to scientists. I talked to people who, like me, were trying to figure shit out, right? So they were not, you know, kind of, you know, in a world that was predetermined. And so kind of for me, kind of, I think many times in my life, jumping into a new place, I got a lot of strength from the fact that it was never as hard than when I lost my family, right? Mm. So, frankly, I remember distinctly many times when we landed on Mars, for example, realizing, hey, this could fail and that's going to be my job almost certainly. And I always thought, well, that's fine. That's would be horrible. It would really have a major impact, but not as big an impact as when I was kicked out. So kind of, so for me, it's that dark thing that gave me this kind of almost a weapon, you know, like you had computer games, right? You pick up these skills that nobody else has. It's kind of some of these things, I just have less fear of that kind of social isolation. Why? I was fully isolated and I made it. So again, the culture shock was there, but far less big than the culture shock of going from a very religious, closed off world, geographically confined, but more emotionally confined, to a world that was bigger and ill-defined. You know, it's like a fish going from a fish tank into the ocean being released. It's like, well, okay, I don't know a single rock and a single bush, but hell, it's big and I love it. Every day I can explore something else. It's scary as hell. I'm not in a fish tank anymore.
How do you deal with that, this shift, you know, from losing your friends, your family, because that's incredibly tough, as you just described. How do you navigate through that emotionally and personally?
Of course, what I did, you know, which is probably not healthy, is I threw myself into my job, right? I worked a lot harder than most people I know, right? So I did my entire master's thesis in half the time than was supposed to happen, and they didn't have the rules. So I just did a second master's thesis on top of that, right? So that's what I did. And then I did a PhD and I did all kinds of other things. Over time, I built friendships, right? Kind of, I realized that, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time. So I was really holding on to her, probably in a way that was unhealthy and probably kind of made it hard for the future of, for both of us, but also for kind of our circle of friends. So again, I threw myself into work, but over time learned how to build other relationships and kind of build out kind of a circle of friends that I was more an agent of deciding whether or not they belonged there or not.
Right. And when you moved to the US, why did you decide to go to the US and not any different country?
I actually tried to go to the UK and it was kind of embarrassing. I had an award-winning, very high-rated PhD thesis. I won a prize from the Swiss National Science Foundation to go and basically a year for free work somewhere. And I could not find a job in the UK where I wanted to go. And the simple reason for that was, by the way, I wanted to go there because I thought my English wasn't good enough. And rightly so, it wasn't good enough. But I couldn't get a job because people thought I'm not appropriately educated, you know, mm-hmm. So kind of there was a, and I gave him a hard time later on in my life, obviously. But the best thing in my life there was that I heard a no. Mm-hmm. So I went to the US and what I did is okay, so I'm going in this enormous place with thousands of universities. How do I find the best place? What I did is I had the idea of, hey, I want to work for somebody who has a track record of supporting young people. So I interviewed people that worked with these, right, kind of the science community. And it was clear that the guy I was going to work with had a huge track record. And I'm the prime example of being supported.
And you then took a job in 96 at the University of Michigan. And you basically founded the Center for Entrepreneurship there. What led you to start that center and why the focus on entrepreneurship instead of any other thing related to science, for example?
So I never had the vocabulary of entrepreneurship. I always, like we invented products over beer in Bern. Like, I mean, some of them are companies now. I'm not the key inventor. I was a sounding board often or even had ideas, right? But I never thought of myself as that. And what I did when I was at Michigan is, of course, I built a research group, learned how to build space instruments, run teams. Like, you know, there are like 40 people that kind of build a piece of hardware that goes to space. But when I started teaching, which I was forced to, I actually did not want a tenure professor. I tried to trade my tenure professorship for a flexible pay scheme with performance base, and that was not possible. So when I did that, I started teaching and immediately started working with companies because I felt that the students needed to be in companies. So I started solving problems. So, you know, I worked with Google Earth, kind of Street View, like a lot of these things, kind of the first kind of concepts that Google worked on with internet from space. We did all the due diligence, like imagery, satellite, you know, so I did a lot of stuff and the university came and said, why don't you run a program for all the students? And I'm such a believer in empowering students, kind of giving them chances, taking them out of their comfort zones. And frankly, I think universities, that's exactly the right place to start during your school to do something, because failing is not that bad. Because, you know, like, so you have this experiment, it's fine. And, you know, so you failed, fine, but you got your degree and that's good, right? So for me, I built this program both focused on students, but also focused on the technologies. The University of Michigan is a very large research organization, and much of the research is in publications, but it's never changing lives. It's like, why the hell would we do that? Like, let's put them into hospitals, save lives, and kind of build companies that make life easier, better, healthier, whatever that might be.
And it seems that you also continued your journey of being very focused on your job, right? You were running the Center for Entrepreneurship. You were involved in associations. You owned your own consultancy. Did you ever find time to rest, or was it really full on work, work, work?
I always put rest into my day. So yesterday I probably was in the office for 12 hours and then I went for a run, yeah. Right? So I took the time for that, right? So for me, resting is always part of it. And there are peak times, right? There's, you know, like when you build a satellite instrument, the last few months before it leaves the Earth, it's like you're working day and night. That's just what it is. And I think it's really great if people have a range. Now, if you're always working in your red range, like, you know, you can not be successful. So it's really, what's important, I think, is to have the awareness. I think I had to learn that over time. I probably my problem was, generally speaking, that I did not emphasize life enough outside of work, right? Kind of. Yeah. By the way, I don't think that life and work need to be opposing each other. Right, they're not for me. But if you look at the mosaic, which is your life, right? Kind of work is in there. Like, so what's on the outside? Like, what are the things you're doing for yourself, for your health? And I did not do, I often work, 16-hour days regularly, right? And then kind of, I did not spend enough time. So over time, especially as I got more intense jobs, that is actually more important because you really bring yourself to the edge otherwise.
Absolutely. And you basically, when you moved to the US, you were an immigrant there. You came from the outside. And a friend of yours, a famous VC investor, Sandy Robertson, once told you, the best way to be an entrepreneur is to be an immigrant. What did he exactly mean by that? And did he also experience that being yourself an immigrant to the United States?
Oh, I think one of the best skill sets that one can have is, and a magic kind of tool in your life, is to be an immigrant. Sandy actually immediately said, I don't actually mean people coming to the US. He's American. He was in the Bay Area, one of the kind of early and most successful investors. But he basically said, what I mean with immigrant is leaving one world and coming into another. And if there's kind of the one thing that my life has been about, it's to be an immigrant, right? Kind of, I decided to leave the world I grew up, went into another world. So kind of going to the US, just another stage. But I did that already before. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think I do that now. So for me, I think what entrepreneurs are great at, if they use their tool of being an immigrant, imagine somebody who grew up just like me, grows up in a farm village and develops tools that help in city traffic, right? What it allows you to do is it allows you to look at the world in ways that the people who have always been there cannot look at. I mean, always imagine when you travel, you go to the bathroom, you look at the shower. It's like, wait, that shower is different than the Swiss shower. By the way, there's less water. That's just like, why is the shower different? Mm-hmm. You go to China, you go to Russia, you go to Japan, you go to Italy, you go, in Italy, there's this, the rope always, and you should not pull because otherwise the police comes, right? So it's like, why do people build things differently? Mm-hmm. See, the issue is, you learn about showers all over the world, but now you look at your own shower differently, right? So for me, that's the magic of being an immigrant. It's the ability of almost going to a different meta layer and looking at the problem top down, not just left and right. So I really think, and frankly, the advice I give to entrepreneurs is learn that, right? Kind of jump into that world. If you write an app for truck drivers, if you're not sitting on trucks, talking to truck drivers, you have no business writing an app for them because you do not understand who your clientele is. Jumping into that other world as an immigrant, learning about it is one of those tool sets. I think it's a profound insight, actually.
Often entrepreneurs that come on the show, they say they had some personal relation to the problem. They want to have a solution for themselves, etc. Do you think that this is a good starting point to start a business? Or is it better to say, I actually want to jump there, truck drivers, for example, spend time with them, understand how it works, and then build a business? Is that the better way to be the immigrant, so to speak?
So I think you can do both, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a strong believer that when you build a company or you build a new project that is really, really hard, you want a personal relationship. The why is what should drive you. No. Like, why is this important? Like, perhaps you build a tool that will help somebody with disabilities because your family member had a disability. That why is very, very powerful. Yeah. But it gives you another kind of magic tool, to be able to look at the problem with more than one way, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the point is, do not despair if you're really close to it. Remember, entrepreneurial entities are successful because of teams, not because of individuals. So what's really important that in your team you build, you also build people who have the different view. So for me, I think a team needs both. It's an alignment, I'm an astronomer or astrophysicist, right? You want to know which star you move towards. Like, right. That's the vision. Like, I'm going in that direction, right? Mm-hmm. That's the direction of good. That's the direction of success. The why is what motivates me. It's not about, I mean, money is good, but God, if that's the why, you know, like, I would never invest in a company where just money is the why, because right. It's like very hard for them to make it. No. There's a lot of science behind that. But the why is good, but the ability to look at the problem in a way that differentiates you from the people who are, like, you know, around there. Remember, wait, if you have a good idea, you know it's a good idea because others had it too.
Right.
Right? It's kind of not, the good idea is not that important. The execution is king.
Absolutely.
Right? And so kind of the ability of looking at the problem top down really helps the execution.
Absolutely. I think that's some very, very valuable learnings and lessons there. I want to now talk about your switch then from Michigan to NASA in 2016. You left the university. What did it feel like to get a job offer from NASA?
Yeah, it's kind of unreal, especially that job, right?
Right.
It's one of those jobs that, you know, if you looked at it, then basically if a young researcher in the field, like, what would be like the three jobs that you would just absolutely want to have without question, that would be one of them.
Right.
You know, because you're basically running the largest science program in the world in and from space, and one of the very largest anywhere that is focused on just exploration and so forth, irrespective of whether it's from space or not, right? And the way it's run is you have a lot of authority. Mm-hmm. So you get the job, it feels unreal, but it's also intimidating as hell, right? There's no way you can be successful. I mean, this is not one of those things where I can get it under control, right? Kind of the only way you're successful, it's, by the way, like a company, like it's a team is fully aligned and kind of believes in the same vision. And in this case, the reason I was hired, by the way, is entirely because of my two career tracks that I had. I had built satellite instruments as a successful researcher, but I also had this entrepreneurial track, right? And frankly, in many ways, that second track is what gave me the job, because the NASA person that hired me basically said, look, we're really struggling. Mm-hmm. Like, this world is, you know, SpaceX, whatever they're called, rocket labs, you know, planet labs, all these things, they're growing and we don't know how to handle them. We need somebody who has, like, if you want, bilingual. So we speak, you know, research language, tech language, but also speaks that entrepreneurial language. So it really is that got me to jump.
So you brought really the skill set that they needed in that moment. At the same time, you also said it's an incredibly big job to take. You cannot really be successful to a certain degree. Did you also think about whether you should accept the job to say, hey, you know, the classic imposter syndrome, like, hey, would I be good enough? Can I actually do this job? Could I be successful in that job?
Yeah, so imposter syndrome is part of most of our lives.
Right.
Those of us who came from another world that is much smaller, most of us, many women have it. I certainly have it. I talked about it. But I never let it made me decide whether or not I'd take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just, like, usually I struggled with it, then I did it anyway.
Yeah.
What was hard about this one, I had another job offer.
Okay.
Because I had a job offer to be one of the big innovation leaders for Jeff Bezos and Amazon. So needless to say, I would be a lot richer if I took the second job that I just talked about. And for me, the question just really is, how do you go about this? Actually, what I decided to do is just look at what's harder to find a person that's better than me. And I thought Jeff would have no problem finding better people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I never knew what I was going to work on. This very confidential, the whole thing. I knew NASA what I was going to work on. And I knew there's very few people who have that other skill set. And it turned out it was a quintessential skill set. And so basically, it was correct. Of course, I made less money working for the government, probably a factor of two less, perhaps five less, you know, as if you looked at bonuses that are part of another job there. But for me, I made the decision based on, hey, it's important. So I believed in the North Star, so to say.
Right.
It is important and I can have an impact because of the skill sets, the benefits of the background that I have.
So it's really also the why that made the difference in the end to help you make your job decision.
Yeah, I basically felt that it is important. I believe in the importance of science, research, and I also believe in, frankly, the inspirational nature that comes from it, especially during a world when people are struggling to find common ground sometimes. You know, we can all agree that the sky is amazing, So let's talk about the sky. As we learn to appreciate each other and our views, now let's go look down at our own planet. Mm-hmm. And kind of forget the stupidity that kind of many people are trying to put between us and kind of find common ground. Most of what we have in our lives is common. Yes, we disagree on stuff. Okay, what are we disagreeing? What are the things we agreeing on? So mm-hmm. let's go find each other there. Then we can deal with the other things too.
Absolutely. You led NASA's science program, and within your job there, you had 37 launches, 55 new missions started during your tenure. Could you tell us a bit more about the ones that stick out?
You know, the hardest one is the one that has been the subject of movies and many articles, that James Webb Space Telescope. Most of the early articles were all horrible, by the way. It's like NASA is losing control and you know, screws are falling off. I mean, just horrible leadership challenges, technical challenges. And then, of course, the totally new view of the universe we've never seen, in that kind of infrared with high resolution, never seen a higher resolution image from space anywhere. So that is one. The other one I would say is probably Perseverance, because we launched it during COVID. Frankly, when COVID happened, by the way, I named the mission Perseverance based on a suggestion of a young man, a middle school student, out of six, over the objection of many, by the way. I named it Perseverance because of my life. I mean, you now know why, right? So I chose it because I thought it was such an important value. And of course, it became the word of the year as a result of that, because of, you know, in part because of the landing. I mean, when they talked about why did you choose that, like a look at that Mars mission in the middle of COVID, everybody's at home and NASA's launching a mission. And frankly, that was not by accident. When COVID happened, I called up my boss and basically said, I called up two people. The first one was the boss and basically said, look, I think we're going to be in for the long haul. It's going to be one of the toughest times for the world. We need hope. So I would like to go and make this a success. He said, yes, I'm with you, for the same reason. Then I went and called the manager and basically said, look, we want to make a run for it. You have every tool available that you need to make that a success. There's one promise that you need to make for me, is like when it's no longer safe for your employees, one call from you and I should turn it off. Mm-hmm. Right. So I basically say, like, I cannot guess from DC whether it's safe from you. Right. You need to tell me. So we did all crazy kind of crazy things. We created an airline for the team, so they never had to go into airports. We actually didn't have a single positive case the whole time. Wow. Until one person who took public transport, yeah, right, kind of, and then she had, but you know, she's fine. So, but this was during the time, of course, pre-vaccines, pre-knowledge, right? So we were really panicking, but we never had, it was safer to work than to be at home for those people. That's how we set it up.
Despite all the challenging state of the world, you still delivered.
Yes, and it was huge, right? Kind of the big LIDAR there in Switzerland, kind of projected Mars images onto the Swiss mountains, kind of in Paris. Like the whole world was celebrating. It was in the news, all in China, everywhere, right? Kind of, and then of course we landed. So that's the other thing. If you go to Mars, you have two news stories: when you launch and when you land. And then we had that helicopter that I also added, which got in the news like every time it lifted off, right? And kind of just another kind of mind-blowing moment, all during a time where people were kind of wondering whether there's hope.
Right. And when such a big mission succeeds and, you know, everyone is celebrating, talking about it, how does that make you feel, you know, as sort of a leader and a very important enabler of the whole mission?
The first feeling is always relief, mm-hmm. because it's my job to think about the good and the bad outcomes. Right. So the first thing you feel is relief. The second one is pride, but not so much pride for myself, but for the team, because it's absolutely clear that the entity that made that happen is the team. I can do a lot of stuff. I can set the culture. I can support the leaders and I can deal with the mission. But it's the team that does it. You know, I want to mention one more mission. As we're making this recording, there's a hurricane barreling in onto Florida, and I've been very you know, of course, concern about the people I know there. I know that much of the predictions come from one spacecraft. That's my first spacecraft I launched, mm-hmm. which is a ghost spacecraft together with the Weather Service in the U.S. And it's that spacecraft that keeps people safe, right? So for me, you know, I have been looking at these images. It's like, how awesome we did that, yeah. right? You know, and again, also there, the team deserves all the credit. But yes, it's great to look at the universe. It's great to look at Mars. But, you know, the value we're getting from space, kind of on a day-to-day basis to save lives, to, you know, protect property, to help make predictions of this most wonderful planet, that's also part of it. Yeah. And I'm very excited about it.
And to protect lives in the end.
Absolutely. There's yeah. many fewer people that die because of it.
Yeah. Wow. That's a huge impact.
Yeah. It's very cool.
And talking about the team, can you tell us a bit more about how it is to lead such a large but also complex team tackling risky and ambitious missions?
So I think what's really important to recognize is any one of those missions, something like 1,000 to 10,000 people that work on it. And you know, some of them are like me, scientists, some or, you know, leaders. Some of them are technicians. You know, they actually build the spacecraft. They touch it. There's engineers that do all the designs. There's operations people and so forth. And then there's people from many different communities, anywhere from artists to writers, then at the end kind of pull the documents together. So it's kind of, it's the ultimate teamwork, right? You know, so for me, and whether it's a company, which may be defined very similarly, or whether it's this, right? Kind of, again, we already talked about it. The most important thing is the team is together on the why.
No.
Like, why are we doing this? And frankly, I think, by the way, whether it's companies or even in project management, I think people do not spend enough time on the why.
No.
And often it kind of, oh, we have communication problems. We have motivational problems. Well, are people explaining? Are people understanding and explaining to each other, reminding each other what the why is? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, and then a noble why, one that we can get behind, right? So for me, that's that. The second thing then is to create an environment in which people can work, right? Kind of that means that money needs to be there, but also that the processes and systems, the way decisions are made, are clear. For me, that mostly means aligning authority and accountability. I don't want to make most decisions.
Sure.
So the decisions need to go down, but they need to go down. The authority needs to go into the team through clear chains of accountability. So it's clear who makes the decision and who stands for it, mm-hmm. right? Kind of what's fashionable often and in many areas. It's like, you know, oh, we make the decision as a team. That's good. But who has responsibility? Like, I want to know. Like, and I'm good. There are styles of kind of doing work where it's just team. I would say a rapidly moving startup often is not that way. Like, who is making the decision? That's also the person with the accountability. That's the person who needs to correct if it's not going right.
So it's that's like the, a bit skin in the game, right?
Exactly right. Skin in the game. And also, hey, it's my butt, yep. right? Kind of it's... I mean, is this the right thing to do? And then it takes, you know, the resilience, the perseverance to pull it off, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's like every single mission I've ever done has a problem, often a major problem. So how do you get through it, mm-hmm. right? This, you know, and kind of the transparency of communication, the clarity of what the mission is about and how we're going to get from A to B. What are the principles we're using that, you know, needs to come from leadership? As always, culture is not just a bottom-up thing. It's very much a top-down thing. What's the culture we expect here? And what are we driving here? So for me, kind of projects like this are very similar to companies. So there's kind of microcosms of it.
Absolutely. The why is so important. You touch up on it over and over again. Do you have, you know, a good example of a why that was driving a team and made it successful, or how you arrived at the why, how you created that for the team?
So we already talked about James Webb Space Telescope, most complex mission we ever did. When I came in, you know, close to $10 billion. When I came in, in 2016, it looked really good, but the spacecraft was really falling behind. Mm-hmm. And initially, everybody says, don't worry, it's fine. It's not on the critical path, which is business speak. Never listen to it. Like, yes, you need to know what the critical path is. But if you have a problem off the critical path that is really bad, you need to handle it. Even if it's not on the critical, it's a really stupid way to think. It's like, oh, a critical path. I'm the leader, only focus on the critical path. That will become the critical path before long. You just go handle it, right? Anyway, so I asked that question, waited perhaps too long, but, you know, so we realized there are all these mistakes that happened. Mm-hmm. There's a propulsion system, 12 propulsion systems, and before they were mounted onto the spacecraft, welded in, somebody cleaned it out with the wrong solvent. Why are we using the wrong? Why didn't you ask what the right solvent is? So every valve was leaking, and with fuel, flammable fuel, right? So we have to cut it out. $150 million, that mistake. Right. So we make mistakes like this. That's a culture where people kind of do 9-to-5 work, right? Kind of it's like not, that's from leadership, right? Mm-hmm. So what we did is, you know, we had to reboot the system, and now comes the communication, right? The first thing we did is basically said, everybody needs to understand what we're doing. So we actually took all the technicians, everyone, back to school and basically said, here's the processes and systems we want you to use religiously. Here's a box. If you worry, we want to hear from you. You're not just, you're really important. You're going to make it successful or not. So that's that. And frankly, what we did is we started giving talks. We had Nobel Prize winners talking to these technicians, right? Kind of like, this is why we do this. This is why this is so amazing. When we launched it to French Guiana to launch with a French crew, we did the same. We said, no, you're now part of the team. We gave everybody gear, like pens and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you're part of the team now. We want to tell you what you're working on. And here's what we learned about working with a $10 billion spacecraft. Most people have never done that, right? So it's like, okay, so how do we do it? Well, you have to be more careful, right? So, but speed also, kind of, it's like running. You have to find the right speed, right? Kind of like going too slowly is deadly. Going too fast, you're never going to make it. So you kind of find the right speed of working. So we talked about all this. So communication in this case was about the why, but also lessons learned.
Right. Does the why have to be quite simple to be easily understood? Although it's a very complex thing that you try to do or to build, but does the why have to be as simple as possible to be replicable and easy to share and understood by people?
Yeah, generally speaking, I think the shorter the why, the easier it is to make it stick. There are whys in some companies that are a little bit more complex, but generally speaking, kind of, I think as a leader, it's really important to kind of boil the why down mm-hmm. and kind of into something that's much easier to hold on to, and then something aspirational. Something that you know matters, but something that has tremendous simplicity. By the way, the simpler we can make the story, the better. It's almost never, except if you want to go into technical problem solving, is kind of more complexity is better. But generally speaking, what we do often in our discussions, kind of, it's an over, it's kind of, those of us who have technical backgrounds, we make that mistake more often than we go into kind of want to explain it better, even though it's not needed. Kind mm-hmm. of the first 5 words were more important than words 5-50, yeah. Right?
Right. So to align a team, more simple is better.
Absolutely simple. Yeah. Simple, simplicity, clarity. And again, think of it like that's the star in the sky we're moving towards. That's the why. Yeah. And every morning you want to be reminded working on something important.
Absolutely. So we already saw, that the NASA missions are, although of course at the completely different scale, similar to launching your own venture. It's higher risk. You have usually a team that is putting in the effort. You need to align everyone. And you also said at the beginning how important that your background, to not only have the research background, but also the startup, the entrepreneurial background, and bringing them together. Can you talk a bit more about how you actually worked with startups at NASA and how you bridged the gap between research and entrepreneurship?
I think it's worth quickly, before I do that, just to quickly say what's different about a startup than a mission. And And the most important part is really that a mission has quite clear goals from the beginning, before we even start in the government, quite clear goals. Whereas a startup has a lot of ambiguity. Like at the beginning, when you start with, you don't even have a business model that works, right? So kind of in many ways, what's hard about a startup is kind of dealing with that ambiguity. That kind of, there's ambiguity in a space mission, but the level of ambiguity in a startup kind of is much higher. Mm-hmm. And remember, many people, they think of kind of the way ambiguity feels is almost the same as to humans than risks. So in other words, a dark forest can feel as scary as a lion screaming in your face, right? Because you, it's like, I wonder what's coming out of here. That's just our genetics kind of training over thousands of years that humanity has had, kind of dealing with ambiguity and risk. And so that's really that's the one thing that's very different. That kind of, you cannot have an ambiguity aversion, right? Kind of the, and kind of the, that's really not a discussion we often have with missions. The second part is just the personal financial risk that often relates to a startup. And I just really don't want to shove that away. Kind of for most people that work on this mission, they will not lose their earnings if something goes badly. Mm-hmm. There's very few people that will. Yeah. But the vast majority of them, they're not kind of in the boat that's taking on water and you just need to make sure you get to the harbor before it's too much or too late. So for me, that's a second thing that's very, very different. There's a lot of leadership that is the same. You mentioned it, but that's different. Mm-hmm. What helped me when I worked with startups and kind of having that kind of both the leadership piece on this was really useful, kind of how startups work, kind of the focus on team, as opposed to just technology, which is, you know, 80% of startups, generally speaking, fail because of team issues. Right. It's not
co-founder split, etc.
Yeah, just crazy kind of personal things. But also for NASA, right, as a government entity, it was really important to learn how to work in a new world in which there are new players that were very different. So there are venture-funded companies that provide services for NASA. And so the question is, how do you, or for other agencies, European Space Agency. So how do you partner with them? Because it's very different. Like, I don't want to dominate what they're building. I want them to build the spacecraft themselves. I want to buy the data at the backside. So how do I create buying models that I can be a customer in that market? One, an anchor customer in a market that never existed before. Mm-hmm. So kind of in many ways, shaping those markets and becoming kind of as a government customer, being aware of the market, seeing it as such, also learning kind of how do I help the company without destroying them, right? Kind of, I don't want to make them different. Like, I do not want them to go through the same processes that we use. I want them to take more risks. Mm-hmm. But I want at the backside to stand there and create certainty in the market, because that allows them to get venture capital. All these things I learned from building companies. So there's multiple places where I build entirely new markets, right? Tens of billions of dollars, right? Kind of that did not exist before, just because we used a very different approach. And kind of without me doing what I did before and working in a venture fund, I would have never known even how to talk to them.
Absolutely. So that's why you were the right man for the job.
Yeah.
But then there was also a time last year in 2022 when you decided to leave your coolest job ever, as you once said it. Why was that the right decision for you to say, hey, after all these years, I'm leaving NASA?
So I think part of it, I just believe, is you want to come to work and just basically have most days be days where you just basically say, hey, I learned something new. Mm-hmm. And I made this place the better place. Kind of a question I always ask myself, am I the best leader that currently I can be and is around? And kind of forward after doing it kind of for six and a half years, I just really, and more longer than anybody ever, like nobody did it that long, right? I basically was like, well, there's multiple days where I came home. It's like, wow, I was really annoyed mostly today, mm-hmm. right? So kind of I'm solving the same problems over and over again. And I like, frankly, interacting with politics kind of in some areas just not as fun as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And then also like, I'm not learning that much. Kind of, I feel like I may sometimes even be the obstacle because I'm like, I think, you know, even though I tried to hide it, you know, can you really tell how I really think about you? Because if you saw, you would not be my friend, right? Kind of, so kind of the question really is, am I learning and am I the best person for the job? And I just really felt that crossed over where I'm no longer, it was no longer net positive.
Right.
But I was at the peak, right? So I felt it was important to kind of, in fact, make that decision before somebody tells you that.
Yeah. That sounds great on the rational level, right? So you step down, you analyze, and then rationally speaking, you come reach your conclusion, okay, I'll leave the job. But then there's also the emotional level. To leave such a job, probably the most intense, but also the coolest and most amazing job you ever had, that's also difficult. How was that for you after you left? Was that difficult on an emotional level?
So it's actually interesting. I'm glad I did. I did call some of the people before who did similar big jobs, and it's like, how did they do it? And frankly, some of it is just PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Kind of your emotions are kind of all over the place. You need some help, right? Yeah. Kind of. So I needed friends. And I told a few friends, I'm going to be here, and I'm not sure how it's going to go. Right. And many of my friends tell me you struggle. So I have this one friend who became one of my closest friends. He checked on me every day. Mm-hmm. Moving fashion, he just called up, hey, I haven't talked to you. It's like, when he didn't see me for 2 days, it's like, hey, I need to see you. Yeah. So he never backed off. Yeah. And, became one of those just champions, right? And of course, I'm not through yet, right? So it's hard. You missed a job.
Yeah.
But it's less, I actually never had a feeling that I should have stayed long.
Okay.
That's actually not the feeling I have. Kind of the two feelings that are negative and that I'm struggling with. On the one hand, I think of things I could have done better,
mm-hmm.
especially because kind of I see how the team is struggling that took over. And I saw this problem and I couldn't turn it around because I was leaving. I was kind of a little bit lame duck, so I could no longer turn the corner. I know exactly what needed to be done, but I could no longer do it because I had announced that I'm leaving. So I have that kind of sense. And the second one is just missing the team. I mean, I love my team. I built a freaking amazing team, right? And I miss them, right? I go to work with the best team. Every time when I leave a job, I really, really, really miss the team.
Yeah.
And so for me, those are the two things. And then, what you need to do is kind of find yourself again and then head for the next target.
Absolutely. And you did so after some reflection and also, I guess, processing the exit at NASA. You decided to come back to Switzerland. You took a job at ETH. You're a professor here now in Switzerland. How was it to come back to Switzerland for you? Because you've spent a decent time in the United States.
Well, I'm again like an immigrant.
Right.
Right. So I have a slightly Americanized Swiss accent. I have an accent in every language I speak, it turns out. So, and I don't get Switzerland. I've never led here. There's many puzzles I have just kind of out life, kind of how decisions are made. It's like, why the hell would you do that? So for me, that's how learning feels, by the way. That's exactly what I'm looking for. And, and I really do believe that some of the biggest problems on earth that I care about are problems that are international, global. And so for me, kind of learning more about this world, kind of Europe more, kind of in Europe, hopefully will prepare me for something yet to come here at ETH and beyond.
And you decided to come to the ETH and not the University of Bern where you studied yourself. Why ETH?
Well, so first of all, you can only get a job that you're offered.
Right.
Right. So kind of that's probably one of the reasons. And the second one is kind of, I think we're a pretty good match because of my very technical background and also science backgrounds. As you know, universities, Bern is an exception in a sense that they're actually much deeper on technical for most of the Canton universities, wherever they are less kind of on technical depth. Yeah. But we're a good match. But fundamentally, I think it's what's really important to me is I actually have no intent to compete against any of the Swiss universities. I think that's ridiculous.
Sure.
The biggest challenge is, frankly, that Europe in space needs to catch up. Like Europe is behind, perhaps 10 years.
Mm.
And frankly, even Switzerland competing against immediately neighboring countries is also ridiculous. I mean, people need to see that the world is a better place if Europe is stronger. And I don't mean some organization of Europe. I just mean the region.
Right. Europe is behind. When you moved to the US in 96, the world was a bit different. Now you decided to come back to Switzerland. Do you think that the United States will be less relevant in the future? And that's also one of the reasons why you came back here to Switzerland?
I'd never bet on negatives. Mm-hmm. I think the world is a better place with a strong U.S. Right. There's a lot of threats from many places, some of them from the inside, from the U.S., where the U.S. is really struggling coming behind the ideals that have shaped the United States, the principles of freedom and liberty for people to do as they please, kind of pursuit of happiness, right? Being a principle. So we should all wish the U.S. well. I certainly did not bet against the U.S. I do believe that every organization, I mean, we would have never guessed in the last 10 years how Europe fell behind, right? Kind of if you look just market-wise, kind of economically, Europe really has struggled, right? And in space especially, really missed the boat, right? And by the way, that's not me saying, like, you listen to the leaders, the European space agents, using different words. But that's exactly what he's saying. And by the way, he's right. But he's also right in the hope, which is, no, I mean, of course we can catch up. We're amazing people with amazing traditions and successes, right? Of course we can do that. And we need to build the kind of the next team, kind of go for the next thing, because leadership is never guaranteed, whether in the US, whether it's in Europe or anywhere else.
And I'm sure that Europe and especially Switzerland is very, very glad to have you back here.
I'm sure many days they are, but I think, see what happens. And I think the same is true at NASA. If there are not days where people are a little bit annoyed at you, you're probably not doing your job either, right? The goal as a leader is not to please everybody. The goal of the leader is to create success and to the benefit of many, by the way, not my own success. But so for me, if we sat here in 10 years, we would have many more startups in space and frankly, a whole ecosystem and startups that everybody would know on Earth right here. And there's absolutely no reason that cannot happen. We have the right people. We have the right ecosystem. The deep tech environment of Switzerland is exactly the right place to do this in aerospace. And so for me, that's important. I think that the second metric would be that the students that are at the universities, whether it's ETH, but also the others, just have more opportunities.
Right.
More opportunities than they have today to kind of join this industry, whether they want to help save the Earth and protect lives, whatever. They can do that, or they can develop, technologies that help humans live on Mars, right? So for me, opportunities for the people. But I think the third piece is really that with a strong Switzerland, kind of a Central Europe overall, we really elevate the human condition and create better and safer environment here on Earth, kind of a planet that, of course, needs to have our attention, not only as a natural environment, but also as a social construct in which kind of tensions arise.
May I ask you about the future, what you have planned now with your new role at ETH? What's your why? What is driving you and your team at ETH? Where do you want to go?
Yeah, grow space in Switzerland, right? I like the play of the word, but really, again, build educational programs that have the kind of correct character I just mentioned. Build a startup ecosystem from the beginning, kind of the kind of entrepreneurial part of that environment is going to be wired into the system. Mm-hmm. So already met with companies today.
Perfect.
Right? By the way, every day, right? Kind of for me, that's what we need to do. And then the third one is really to kind of connect with the environment in a way so the kind of the water level goes up, generally speaking, but really opening space for Switzerland.
Fantastic. Thomas, to wrap up the conversation today, we have some rapid fire questions for you. I'm going to ask you the question and ideally you answer in one sentence. Uh-huh. You ready?
Uh-huh.
Considering your decades of experience, I got to ask, Switzerland or the United States?
Both for me. It's very hard to imagine of myself in only one half of who I am.
Do you ever wish you had gone to space yourself?
I hope to go to space before I die.
Nice. Have you ever regretted not taking that job at Amazon back then?
I am glad I took the job that I took right now. And if there's an opportunity to go work for Amazon, I may consider that very seriously.
And what's the best quality a leader can have?
Trustworthiness.
And what's the best quality an entrepreneur can have?
Vision.
Yeah. And the last one for you, Heiligenschwendi, Zurich or Bern?
They're all parts of my life right now, Zurich.
Perfect. Thomas, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure to have you here. All the best, lots of success, and I'm sure we're going to hear, read, and see a lot from you in the future.
Yeah, and thanks so much, and thanks for everything you do, and especially all the people listening who are doing their own entrepreneurial ventures. You know, entrepreneurs are the people that build the future, and so thanks for being part of that community, a community of hope and a community of perseverance.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.